The Mark Stein Club Q&A, live around the planet, begins in 30 seconds.
Hey, this is Mark Stein. This Saturday, we'll be turning the clock back 8 decades in anticipation of the D-Day anniversary. Sinatra will sing the great songs of wartime parting from 3 of the Allies, Britain, Canada, America, and we'll hear the only hit that soldiers on both sides liked. On the Town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
'Cause you've been
welcome along. 'Tis I, the guilty party. We are not sure at this hour whether Donald J. Trump has joined me in that club. If we get an update while we're on the air, we shall bring it to you. May 29th, 2024. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London, where they're gripped by election fever. Supposedly. 9 p.m. in Lyon, where 3 people were stabbed on the subway of France's third largest city in a sudden outbreak of vibrant diversity. 10 p.m. in Kyiv, where Zelensky is being encouraged by Macron, who seems far more interested in Ukraine than in France. Zelensky's being encouraged by Macron to bomb more targets inside Russia. Bring it on, baby! Made it! Top of the world! 10:30 p.m. in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran out of solidarity with the half-hour time zone. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers. Very sorry about that. 5 a.m. in Singapore and not Singapore. We've done Singapore. That's 3 a.m. That's bad enough. It's 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne. 7 a.m. in Auckland, and a rather more civilized hour for the Kippers and Kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. As I said, no verdict from the Trump trial yet. I think Judge Méchant, is that it? French name? Judge Méchant is in the seventh hour of his jury instruction. Oh, has he finally shut up? Oh, he's shut up. So it will be with the jury for another 90 minutes. Then they break for the day. Evil judge, evil system. Have to be a bit circumspect about what I say, because, as you know, it is a condition of my admission to this great republic that I do not foment a violent revolutionary overthrow of the government. However, I do feel just a teensy-weensy touch of fomenting coming on. What are you going to do? Deport me? In less than 2 weeks, I shall be in London against the advice of my doctors. But so what? I laugh at doctors. Ha! In fact, I scoff at doctors. How's that working out for me? Could you move that defibrillator a bit closer? I can't quite reach it from there. As you know, this month is the 7th birthday of the Mark Stein Club. I thank, from the bottom of my heart, or from the heart of my bottom, as the late Steve Wright of BBC Radio used to say, I thank all those first month founding members who've decided to re-up for an 8th year. And I hope that our tardier joiners will want to do the same in the coming days. Thank you also to those of you who've signed up a chum for a Mark Stein Club gift membership. I certainly hope they're still speaking to you. Today, May 29th is Oak Apple Day or Royal Oak Day. At least that's what they used to call it in the British Isles, celebrating the restoration of the crown in May 1660 after Cromwell's son bungled Britain's brief flirtation with non-monarchical government. Royal Oak Day commemorates the Battle of Worcester, when Charles II escaped the Roundheads by hiding in an oak tree on the Shropshire-Staffordshire border. I've been in that field. Oak Apple Day was a bank holiday in England, Ireland and Wales. Don't think it was ever one in Scotland, but correct me if I'm wrong. And people took it very seriously. If you didn't wear an oak leaf on your lapel, you risked getting pelted with birds' eggs or, in some parts of the realm, having your bottom pinched, hence its alternative name of Pinch Bum Day. Oh, you can laugh, but as we discussed on GB News at the time, pinched bums in the bar of the Carlton Club is what ended the premiership of Boris Johnson, whose capacious posterior I have no desire to goose whatsoever, but a prime ministership that self-detonates over pinched bottoms at the Carlton Club is a first in British history. Why do we talk about this stuff? Because if you have no sense of history, and in particular, if you have no sense of your own history, if you have actually no feeling for the feet that have walked before you in your land, then you are a patsy and a pushover for whatever comes along. I was thinking about the loss of historical memory when I was watching that little video clip of the deputy leader of the Labour Party kissing up to her all-male Muslim audience. And those Muslim guys know the bits of history that matter to them, like Muhammad. I don't suppose they know about Oak Apple Day, but I don't suppose the ginger growler has ever heard of Oak Apple Day either. The best way to lose your future is to lose your past. Okay, that's enough of that. Happy Royal Oak Day to the, or happy Pinched Bum Day, however you care to celebrate it. And let us get to your questions, which is what this show is all about. Saul Good, possibly not his real name, writes, Mark, we all know the thinking on quick or same-day verdicts. Maybe I don't understand how it works, but it seems hard to believe, even skipping a lunch break, that they could deliver judgment on 34 counts in a day with due diligence. But then, according to Dershowitz, the judge instructed them that they didn't have to believe Cohen, that's Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, to find him guilty. No assembly required purchase I have made in my life came with clearer instructions. Look, a quickie verdict generally means that the guys made up their mind on day one and want to get the hell out of there. I'm not, you know, sometimes the length of time they take is just, you know, a bit of pro forma stuff to make it look like they deliberated, because they're meant to deliberate. But, you know, you'll forgive me if I'm a bit cynical about it after what I went through in the District of Columbia. I don't think it's worth, this is actually what, you know, everything that happened here was like deja vu all over again for me. My case wasn't important. They're just screwing over a niche Canadian, so who cares? But this is the leader of the opposition, as they say in functioning societies. And so what's being done to the fact that they're basically using the same model that was applied to me right down to bringing up the January 6th guys in the closing arguments. The only difference, by the way, is that because he's slightly more important than a niche Canadian, they had these, I think it's like jury intimidation, really, jury nobbling. I don't actually know why it's permitted. I don't know why the Robert De Niro thing was permitted. And I certainly don't know why the political opponents of the accused man are allowed to politicize the trial by having their little thing going on outside the courthouse. But we had supposedly a guy who purported to be from the Capitol Police, which is a crap police force. But he was saying, oh, you know, and then all these Trump supporters on January the 6th. This is the only thing that matters in a country, in its legal system, certainly, in its, but that has an implication for everything else, is equality before the law. If you don't have equality before the law, then you don't have, there's no point standing up there and wanking around with your stupid constitution. If you don't have equality before the law, and if you have a constitution, I'm getting really mad about this. As I said, I feel a lot of fermenting coming on because of the pretense. It's part of the problem. When you have legal analysts talking about this, now they've just decided, they say, well, what crime is Trump supposed to have committed? Oh, you don't have to agree on what crime he's committed. You just have to, you know, pick a crime you happen, there's all kinds of crimes out there, you know, so he could have murdered somebody, he could have broken into a liquor store, he could have double parked. As long as four jurors, he spelt this out, this Judge Méchon, he spelt this out. As long as three groups of four jurors agree that Trump has committed some crime, that will be treated as a unanimous verdict. This is evil. That's why I'm sorry. And if the INS or whatever they're called this week need to come and kick the door down, send the SWAT team and put 130 bullets in me, I quite understand, because I understand it. I may not actually be fermenting technically, but I am trembling on the brink of fermenting the overthrow of the United States government. Robert Bridges says, elsewhere in the dysfunctional US, NYC, New York City is one-upped even Stalin and Beria. Now it is, show me the man, I don't need a crime, as President Trump awaits the jury's verdict. It is worth noting that in Soviet show trial, I don't believe, if you can find me an example, but I don't believe in all I know of Soviet show trials, that they said, if the jury, if you can find him, if you don't agree on what he's guilty of, just let us know and we'll do a sort of tie a big bow and ribbon around the group and take it as a big group unanimous verdict if you find him guilty of different things. So you're right. It's now, show me the man, I don't need a crime, as President Trump awaits the jury's verdict. Can't waive that constitution as it was written in cursive. And no one in New York can read it or anything else. This, dear friends, is now the new and improved living constitution with advanced on-the-fly real-time updates. All of this to belittle Trump and humiliate those that want their country back. Can't we just get along? Is as dead as Rodney King. What is interesting to me is what happens next. Because unlike the legal analysts seem to think that what happens next is, oh, yeah, he's found guilty and then he gets to appeal it. And, yeah, OK, the New York appellate court isn't great. But, you know, if he gets it to the U.S. Supreme Court, then it'll be overturned there. So you're banking on John Roberts to save your republic. You're banking on John Roberts to save your republic. They don't need to do that. They figured all they need to do is take him at, you know, there's an election coming up in November. So if you tie him up, if you take him out of the game until November, who cares what the Supreme Court rules? You know, and by that time, you know, some other guy has going to... By the way, it's all working out so... I love all this stuff. Oh, Joe Biden, a lot of people are happy, unhappy with Joe Biden. Joe Biden, there's talk about getting rid of Joe Biden. Actually, they're going to pre-nominate him because of some problem with the Ohio Constitution or whatever rubbish it is. They're going to pre-nominate him virtually, him and Kamala. So they'll still have the Constitution as a bit of harmless dinner theatre, but it'll be coming like 2-3 weeks after they've already renominated him. So he's cruising to nomination. What happens next? All the norms of prudence, things you would not do if you thought the tranquility of the republic was important. What they're doing, the people who are behind this, what they're doing is trashing those norms, in part because they figure that the more extreme they are, the more it works for them. And, you know, when you look at and again, with all the usual qualifiers, the polls may be rubbish. And beside, the polls themselves presume that it's going to be permitted to hold a fair election. But the polls seem to be tightening a bit compared to where they were a couple of months ago, which would suggest that the Democrat strategy of outrageously indicting Trump and prosecuting Trump, and actually convicting Trump may have some benefits. You forget that most, you know, people who follow, you know, whatever it is, the talk radio shows or whatever, that's a hugely small percentage. I remember I used to occasionally compare the ratings I got on Tucker. They liked me at Tucker because I held the audience. But the audience we were holding, and I believe they're kind of a million down in prime time since they got rid of Tucker. So they're talking about 2 million people, which isn't even 1% of the population. Now, you think what the other 99% of the people are watching, and then think, well, do they know that this is a show trial? Do they know that this awful, evil judge... Oh, I mustn't ferment. It's, I'm sure, I don't know, that's the courts are a branch of government, so I probably can't even ferment the overthrow of this awful judge without becoming ineligible for retaining admission to this great republic. But... you think how many people even know about this atrocity that they can convict Trump? Four people, three groups of four people can convict Trump of different crimes, and it will be treated by Judge Méchon as a unanimous verdict. Evil, evil, evil. And actually, the pansies prancing around with the Constitution. You're post-constitutional. If you don't understand that, you know, these judges are the guys who interpret your constitution. Where did they get that from? You know, so get real or get lost. One of the things that I get slightly irritated about, I'm cranky today, okay? That's why and because I can't foment the violent overthrow of the United States government, my crankiness and my inclination to foment gets diverted onto other targets that I'm permitted to foment against. But we are in a huge hurry. We are running out of time to have any peaceful course correction. Absolutely running out of time. So the fact that you have a conservative establishment whose legal scholars are playing along with this as if it's, you know, a respectable court case. They're effectively dignified by analysing it as if it were the kind of case you'd find in the district court at your county courthouse or whatever. They're actually dignifying what's really going on, which is that it's a nakedly political prosecution with no basis in law. And it's advertising that there is no law now. Now, Hillary Clinton can do one thing. We just heard today that basically Peter Strzok and what was her name? Lisa Page, his paramour, that they're close to the settlement, right? The settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice. These are the ones who were talking all about the plan B for in the event that Trump should get elected. These were the ones behind Crossfire Hurricane. Peter Strzok was the guy flying off to London, going to Australia House to set up the setup with the guy in the bar, the wine bar in London. Right? They're going to get paid for what they did. They're going to get a settlement from the Department of Justice. No one's going to drag them into court, right? For trying to subvert the 2016 election. They're making money off their subversion. Evil system, evil country. Don't bring up that constitution because it hasn't protected you from any of this. It's enabled it all. And the only thing America will be remembered for, as things stand, is that it was on America's watch that the entirety of our civilization went crashing off the cliff. Do you think anyone's going, oh, the death of Western civilization occurred during the third Biden term? But one must respect its fabulous constitution. Do you think anyone, whoever's left to write history, is going to be saying that? The divine Dali. Hello, Dali. I presume that's a reference to Salvador Dali, not dear old Dalida, the late French singer whose voice I very much liked, says the Trump case raises the specter of third world style lawfare consuming the Republic. It would be great if members of the various factions put aside their differences and spoke out in the name of common sense. Maybe, just maybe, this might be starting. Take the example of Bill Maher, for instance. We need more like him. Well, that's true, but Bill Maher's been like this for quite a while now. He's never been hot for Islam. And he's been attacked by the left for his alleged Islamophobia. But by the way, somebody said in the comments, and I generally agree with this, I think it was Diane Calabresi, was it? Said, didn't like the name lawfare, it's too weak. Lawfare is a term that I think it actually started getting currency at the time of my difficulties with the Canadian Human Rights Commissions. So we're going back almost two decades now. And it seemed the appropriate term then for picking off, you know, some rinky-dink columnist or author of a best-selling book or whatever, and in ensuring that all his book royalties get consumed in litigation for a decade or whatever. That's fine. Lawfare's an adequate term for that. But it isn't adequate for the state during the election campaign, ensuring that its political opposition is tied up in court all day long. And that's not, on the whole, what third world type places do. Some third world places actually have semi-functioning judiciaries. I remember one, for example, the court rulings in the latter part of Robert Mugabe's reign in Zimbabwe. Those judges actually did their jobs and helped bring his regime to an end. So I don't think. And then you have the other kind of third world country where they, like Argentina under the junta, used to just put people on a plane, fly them out over the ocean, and shove them out of the plane. So this particular thing is a very, I don't think it's correct to talk about it as a third world thing. It's American. And again, we get here to owning the catastrophe, right? Because a lot of things come from America, like the whole general wokery, which has been incubated by the United States, then spread to those nations that mimic the United States, chiefly His Majesty's dominions. And it's actually non-English countries where they say, well, wait a minute, this is all stupid. We're way beyond the thing. And it's why, again, people, language is important, right? So there's no point saying banana republic, because by definition, a banana republic is some ramshackle, peripheral, unimportant state on the fringe of the map. You can't apply that to the United States. It's different when the leader of the free world is making with the bananas. You know, again, the right need to get serious about some of this stuff. Scott Scherzer writes from Miami Beach. Dear Mark, why is it that actors and other celebrities are so quick to make asses of themselves when it comes to politics? Robert De Niro's embarrassing display yesterday outside of Trump's courthouse is just another in a long line of these instances. Is it some sort of guilt they feel at making so much money for doing relatively little to earn it? Mr. De Niro seemed very small and not at all like his persona on the big screen. Perhaps next time he'll invite Joe Pesci along to provide some muscle. Good luck in next month's trial, and hoping to see you happy and healthy in April on the Stein cruise, says Scott from Miami Beach. Yeah, if you didn't see this was Robert De Niro wearing a mask. I don't know, you know, that didn't work out. That's one reason, a small reason, the overvaluation of the celebrity class. If you recall, on the eve of the 2016 election, when Trump was campaigning hard in Michigan, Hillary was at some big rally with all these pop stars and movie actors and all the rest of it, which did nothing for her. I think someone like Robert, you know, an actor is a singer. Singers are slightly different, I think, but an actor is someone who is as good as his script, and who is as good as his director, and who is as good as his casting. That's the reality of it. Those are all very particular things. You need a good script, you need to have the right people for it, and you need to have it well directed. And then the guy, for some reason, the guy gets the idea that he can do without the script, he can do without the director, he can do without the casting, and what you get is someone like De Niro. I don't think that influence. I don't think even the Democrats basically... if you were to normal Democrats, people who aren't activists, but just people who go and vote for Democrats because they seem to have all the nice fluffy words, so they seem to be on the side of the angels. They're not persuaded by someone like Robert De Niro. That's just a disaster for them. I noticed it with, I think I said this to Tucker one time on the air, because we were talking, he brought up Alec Baldwin's Trump impersonation, which is terrible. Alec Baldwin's Tony Bennett impersonation was brilliant, because he played the dotty subtext of Tony Bennett that he got brilliantly. It was a brilliant, his Tony Bennett was a brilliant thing, and by comparison he missed the essence of Trump, you know, and that Alec Baldwin's Trump could not have won the election. I think we're at the stage where there just isn't anything in common anymore. And it's hard to imagine you can have a shared polity with that. Let's see. Seth says, hi, Mark. I enjoyed watching your interview on Uncommon Knowledge from 14 years ago. This is what we reposted on Friday from 2010. As usual, your predictions were correct, and you get little credit for it. On the final question of the interview, you were answered that you still consider yourself a happy warrior. and thought things could be turned around. After all that has happened since then, I am less and less optimistic, and I feel you are as well. Was there a certain moment or event you think pushed America to go past the point of no return and sealed our fate to be like Western Europe? Or was it the accumulation of endless wars, COVID, demographic decline, obliteration of the value of citizenship, etc.? Your thoughts? Well, there was a point when I just concluded that America wasn't serious. I guess the point at which I spent most time in Washington was the months before the release of America Alone and the months afterwards, in part because certainly after the book came out, I was getting invited by Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condi to come in and talk about it. And but some of them I'd run into before the book and everything. When I spoke to them, I thought they were serious people who appeared to be serious about finally throwing off the psychological damage of Vietnam and demonstrating that America was a nation that could seriously prosecute its national interests in the world. And it quickly emerged, it gradually emerged, that in fact, you know, people talk about the US military as if it's just gone woke. No. A decade and a half ago now, the idiot chiefs of staff were mandating that every soldier shipping out to Afghanistan had to have in his kit bag a free copy of Three Cups of Tea, this ludicrous book, a book, in fact, that turned out to be a fraud, that said, you know, if you meet a, you know, some Pushtun warrior and you have three cups of tea with him, then he is your friend for life. And at that point, and the fact that the book turned out to be a fraud, I can't get over this business with the pier at Gaza, particularly because we're coming up to the D-Day anniversary. As you may have heard just at the top of the hour, we're doing a D-Day special for my show this weekend. But that was one of the big things about D-Day, that the after the Dieppe raid, and every Canadian will know about that because the Canadians, I think 3,500 Canadians died in the Dieppe raid. It was a disaster. And guys running the war realized that you couldn't sail across the English Channel and try to take a French town. So you would have to, there was no point. You couldn't do that again. You couldn't land and try to take the harbour at Calais or whatever, even Biarritz. You would have to go somewhere where there wasn't a harbour and construct a harbour that the big ships would be able to put up at. And I quoted Jim Radford's song because he was 15 years old and he was basically the galley boy on a tugboat that sailed onto the French coast and put up these artificial harbours that had been invented in the wake of the Dieppe raid, the so-called Mulberry harbours. Because they only had one chance to get it right. The Germans understood this. Once D-Day was underway, they weren't the best troops they had in Normandy. But the German officers understood what was at stake. They said, we have to throw them back into the sea or the war is lost. Well, the Mulberry harbours prevented, and they would have been thrown back into the sea if it had been like the Dieppe raid. But the Mulberry harbours prevented that. Now we have, there's no war. There's no war, supposedly. All they have to do, there's nobody's going to fire on the guys putting up that pair at Gaza. All they had to do was get the pair right. And they didn't. So it's like broke off and bits of it have floated up the coast to Israel. Four ships ran aground. Four US vessels ran aground, two of them in Israel. So people are doing jokes about it. You know, Joe Biden said he wasn't going to have boots on the ground. Well, he's got boots on the ground because U.S. personnel have had to go ashore in Israel and try to get those ships back. Well, people say, oh, no, he didn't mean boots on the ground. He meant they wouldn't have boats on the ground. Well, he's got two boats on the ground. You know, it's actually we're past. This is the point now. You account for 40% of the planet's military spending, and you can't do the D-Day. There was you couldn't say have a flop D-Day and then try it again 10 days later. It was all or nothing. And I look at those awful men, these awful people, career. Oh, he's a four-star general. Oh, he's a four-star. Got to all be impressed by the four-star general. Why? What war has he won? What win? What, or even if he didn't win it, what one war has he been in? Why? So we've got a choice between, you know, the peacenik, right? Oh, we're totally against violence, except for these guys who parachute into your peacenik music festival and then gang rape all the women. That violence really turns us on. So you got that on the left, and then you got the moron right doing this. Oh, thank you for your service. Thank you for your service in another unwon war. Why is it? This was true over a decade ago when that guy Kagan wrote the stupid book about the world America made 10 years ago. And I reviewed it and I thought it was one of the most stupid books I'd ever read. And I said, the whole way of war needs rethinking. And instead, we've just doubled down on it because it's a racket. Because as whoever it was said, the great thing about the Ukraine war is that it's fantastic for the American economy. Anyway, I'm getting a little excited here. I need to calm down for a bit. As you know, all the music has moved to my show on Serenade Radio. That's 5 p.m. London time, 12 noon North American Eastern on Saturday. Mark Stein on the town. Do try and catch the D-Day show. It's a different world. And I'm glad it's a different world because, you know, after immersing myself in the D-Day anniversary for a bit, you really do realize about how we've just lost it. But anyway, we don't really have music on this show anymore because we want to be able to talk about Mitch McConnell nonstop because that's what matters. How great is that? Mitch McConnell for the full hour. However, as I said, it is Oak Apple Day, Royal Oak Day. So here's a related song, first sung on New Year's Eve 1759. By Samuel Thomas Champneys on stage at the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane, during that season's pantomime, Harlequin's Invasion. 1759, New Year's Eve. If you weren't there that night, you may well know it from Patrick Stewart in Star Trek The Next Generation. Today, it is the official march of the Royal Navy, the Royal Canadian Navy, the Royal New Zealand Navy, and a bunch of other navies. However, we're going to hear it for reasons I'll explain in a couple of minutes from Jerry Bryant and Starboard Mess, celebrating the sturdy oak from which the ships were built and the sturdy men who manned them.
Come cheer up, my lads, 'tis to glory we steer, to add something more to this wonderful year. To honour we call you, not press you like slaves, for who are so free as the sons of the waves? Heart of oak are our ships, heart of oak are our men. We always are ready. Steady, boys, steady. We'll fight and we'll conquer again and again. We ne'er see our foes, but we wish them to stay. They never see us, but they wish us away. If they run, why we follow and run them ashore. For if they won't fight us, we cannot do more.
Heart of oak are our ships, heart of oak are our men. We always are ready. Steady, boys, steady. We'll fight and we'll conquer again and again.
They swear they'll invade us, these terrible foes. They frighten our women, our children, and beaux. But should their flat bottoms in darkness get o'er, still Britons they'll find to receive them on shore.
Heart of oak are our ships, heart of oak are our men. We always are ready. Steady, boys, steady. We'll fight and we'll conquer again and again.
We'll still make 'em fear and we'll still make 'em flee. And drop 'em on shore as we've dropped 'em at sea. Then cheer up, my lads, with one heart let us sing. Our soldiers, our sailors, our statesmen and king.
Heart of oak are our ships, heart of oak are our men. We always are ready. Steady, boys, steady. We'll fight and we'll conquer again and again.
Heart of oak are our ships, heart of oak are our men. And that's why I played that version by Jerry Bryant and Starboard Mess, because that first line of the chorus makes explicit the connection between the material that built the ship and the character of the men aboard. And if you're at a naval event in Britain, Canada, or anywhere else these days, and they sing that song, they now sing, "Heart of oak are our ships, jolly tars are our men," which I don't care for. I think it's a bowdlerisation, and it irritates me. Music by William Boyce, words by David Garrick. Yes, the same chap. The Garrick Club, which has just wimped out and abandoned its male-only membership rules. The same Garrick that the Garrick Club's named after. You can't have male-only activities anymore, unless it's an election event in a heavily Muslim neighbourhood in England, in which case, feel free, be as all-male as you want. But until the Garrick Club goes majority Muslim, circa 2032, they're not entitled to that exemption. So no end to the faggotry, as His Holiness Pope Francis told his Italian bishops a few days ago. Wait a minute, isn't that another illegal all-male institution, the Italian bishop pricks? Well, don't blame me, by the way, for that word. It's the pontiff's word, not mine, and he has papal infallibility. More music on Saturday on our D-Day special. Mark Stein on the town, 5 p.m. London Town, 7-8 Radio, midday Eastern if you're in New York or Toronto. We are live around the planet. It is 18 to 4 North American Eastern Time. That is 18 to 9 British Summer Time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent Earth. Before we get back to your questions, we have something exciting. We have a Judge Méchon says the jury has sent a note with four requests. They want David Pecker, he's the National Enquirer guy, David Pecker's testimony regarding his phone conversation with Trump, Pecker's decision not to finalise and fund the assignment of McDougal's life rights, Pecker's testimony regarding the Trump Tower meeting, and Michael Cohen's testimony regarding the Trump Tower meeting. So I'm not sure we had... Did we have a jury note in my trial? I don't think we did. So that may be a sign. I think that they're going to go till tomorrow at least. Chris Davis says, Mark, I hope you're well. What do you think of Rishi Rich's idea of voluntary national service? I'm sure the over 65s will be delighted at the prospect of their grandkids receiving military training and discipline, and absolutely nothing to do with being on the verge of war with Putin, of course. Keep well. Yeah, this is the background to it. He apparently sprung this, Rishi Rich, on the public without consulting relevant cabinet ministers. I mean, for example, the secretaries of state for Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. This is directly in their bailiwick, and he's at least supposed to have run it by them. And he didn't. He didn't bother mentioning it to them. I think the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland has gone off, flounced off in a big Queenie huff, and he's spending the rest of the election campaign in the Greek islands or something. He's not going to. Anyway, but you're quite right that for a start, this is the lamest. I said the other day that this is one thing, calling for a return of national service, which is conscription. Basically, and a lot of people enjoyed doing a couple of years, 3 years or whatever it was in the military. I used to talk to Oberon, the late Oberon Waugh, about it. He actually shot himself in some rather bizarre accident. But despite that, he enjoyed his national service. People liked doing national service generally. And then the minute it ended, all the crusty old Shire Tories were always calling for the return of national service whenever they were confronted with some aspect of youth culture that they found absolutely revolting. That country's dead, okay? All those Shire Tories are dead, but that Britain is dead. That youth culture is, all the mods and rockers and the smelly old hippies and the nose-ringed punks and all the rest of it. They're all dead. They're all gone. It's a different country now. And it is interesting to me about, you know, the first thing that we'll be having is there'll be exemptions, you know, for Muslims. I would love to do 3 years in the army, but unfortunately I have already accepted a very generous offer from ISIS, so I won't be able to do it. But thank you very much for the invitation. There's going to be all those exemptions. But Chris puts it against a slightly darker side. There's this tremendous push get us used to the idea that we are on the verge of World War III. Now, Putin is not an idiot. And Putin has spent, despite the provocations of the last 2 years, has been very careful not to escalate beyond a certain point. Because he doesn't want to find himself in a war with NATO. What's interesting is that the war talk, the Third World War talk, is all coming from the NATO side. And you have to wonder what is behind that, because as we just saw with the pier in Gaza, if we got into a war with Russia, we'd lose, just because we're lousy and can't win nothing. You know, that was the lesson Putin took from the fiasco in Kabul. You spend 20 years, a fortune. We're just talking about the treasure, not the blood. And the system you spend 20 years building collapses in 20 minutes. Which, again, people talking about why I got disenchanted. I wrote that the 24 hours after the last NATO soldier departed Afghanistan, there would be no sign that we were ever there. And that came to pass. You really think we can win a war against Russia or China? You look at that pier business. Oh, it was slightly rough seas. Yeah. They had rough seas in the English Channel too, but they understood that there was one. By the way, they built the technology. The technology had never really been tested. Certainly had never been tested on the fly. Nobody knows any. I'm amazed all the people going, thank you for your service, never actually bother to study any military history. But they built that technology, and this was basically the pilot program for it that they had to do on the fly. The only thing they learned, as I said, they took away one big lesson from the fiasco of the Dieppe raid, which cost a lot of Canadian lives. You couldn't land at a harbour to take back Europe, because that just couldn't be done. So you effectively had to go somewhere where there wasn't a harbour and put a harbour in place. Right. Well, this isn't anything like that. They're not facing the Germans on the coast of Gaza. They don't have to do anything except get the stupid pier right. And they couldn't do that. And I'm really worried about the way less and less works in our society anymore. So this Rishi Rich thing about the national service, I think the idea is... It's like a 1984 type move, you know, where the idea of permanent war. So they're trying to implant the idea of permanent war by creating this sort of national service thing. So, I'm going to have to go and do. Yeah, I was hoping to just spend another few years standing outside expressing my support for Hamas. But they've said that for 3 years I've got to do the national service because the Third World War is imminent. They're trying to get us used to that for a reason. Odd. Biddeford Jake says, "Dear Mark, I'm wondering if I can ask our local priest to say a mass for you regarding your upcoming case with Ofcom. I might have to disguise it under special intentions." You're certainly welcome to do that, Biddeford Jake. It's a very nice thought. I could use some prayers on this next case. Doubtless, when you fly into London and survey again its metamorphosis, you might agree with that crusty old curmudgeon, John Cleese, that once a city loses its parent culture, it will never return. John Cleese, I like him. Actually, he said some nice things about me when he was given a tour of GB News for his terrible show. He made the mistake of agreeing to do with them. But John Cleese doesn't, on this sort of stuff, he never quite goes far enough for me. The fact is, John, all the people that John Cleese mocked, you know, like the Ministry of Civil Walks, that was the bowler-hatted British civil servant, they're all gone now. All that's gone. The military officers, they're all gone. They're all woke now. Even the ones of them who aren't actual trannies are all woke. London, part of the reason why London is the way it is because he won. And this is the thing with counterculture. One of the reasons we're in a hole now is because the counterculture won and became the culture. And the right has not managed to come up with a counterculture to counter the counterculture. Biddeford Jake goes on, "Being a recent convert to your work, I hadn't realised you had made quite so many programmes for the BBC during their late glory years. Were you allowed a political view? Looking briefly at the archive, I'd have loved to have heard your show on Ring Lardner, a familiar name about whom I know nothing." Actually, I've played one of the songs. I had a slightly odd experience on that because it's an adaptation of Ring Lardner's short stories, and he has parody songs in those short stories. Ring Lardner is a great American sports writer. He's one of the reasons I fell in love with the American language. And he was also a frustrated songwriter. Anyway, he has all these parody lyrics, and I thought, it'd be fun in this adaptation to set some of those to music. And So a composer was hired, and this was just like one of those terrible things. He was too good. So the tunes weren't bad enough for what they were meant to be. So in the end, with sort of 48 hours or something to go, I wound up like writing all the tunes myself, because if there's one thing I know how to do, it's write a bad tune. I hadn't thought about that. We had Stubby K starring in it, who was... I remember in the morning he changed all the keys. After we'd agreed all the keys, he changed them all. But we play one of those songs. I think it's one of our live music specials. I dug out one of the songs, and you can hear Stubby K singing it there. Okay, how's it going? Also, quote-unquote, with the delightfully gentle and whimsical Arnold Brown. Quote-unquote. Do you know, the thing about the BBC was full of leftists when I was there. They were all lefties, really. But they were civilized lefties. They weren't moronic lefties. And so the BBC in particular had all these sort of civilized little parlor games. You know, quote unquote was one of those quote unquote quiz shows, you know, where you'd be asked questions about something somebody had said in 1643 or whatever. But the point wasn't to... get the question correct. The point was to tell some amusing literate anecdote that would add to the general conviviality of the occasion. And they were all like that. I mean, things like My Music and My Words. Some of you will know them because, you know, when I've been sort of driving around at 3 a.m, 30 years ago, I'd occasionally hear them on NPR or whatever. But... it must have been a kick to work for the Beeb and live in London during the late 80s and early 90s. Sadly, now both have gone to seed. Yeah, I will say that you can tell I'm rhapsodizing when I talk about, like Bananarama living in... Denmark Street, which is the heart of the British music business. One of the Sex Pistols had an office there and he didn't use it. So he said to the girls that they could sleep there because they didn't have anywhere else to go. I like the way I think back. It was and then the crazy musicals you used to get where the government of Nauru, that's that little island that basically is an island of bird droppings near Australia in the Pacific. The people who try to get to Australia wind up in a camp on Nauru, and they invested in some. Was that the Tom? People used to just like pitch terrible musicals to you all the time. I can't remember. There was one they wanted to do. One about Edward. King Edward VIII and Mrs. Simpson with Tom Jones. I remember saying to the producer over breakfast, "Oh, which role would Tom be playing?" but they were. It was a happy time, as I think, compared to being in litigation in the District of Columbia Superior Court. It was a happy time. So, thank you. Thank you for reminding me of that, Biddeford Jake. Raymond Kujawa says, it has seemed that the only way that the corrupt courts can be induced to make anything approximating a decision actually respecting people's rights or give proper due process is when a trial is broadly exposed to the court of public opinion in a matter which would make courts look ridiculous, assuming that is still possible these days. What I'm curious about is whether anyone in the UK is paying attention to your upcoming Ofcom case and what is the quality of the coverage? What would the consequences for the government be if Ofcom's decision is overturned? No chance of bringing down the government if the vaccine falsehoods are exposed for the complete fantasy they turned out to be, with so many people mistrusting the health authorities with their lives and getting burned. Finally, any chance the Tourism Trivia Channel, aka GB News, might be covering the trial, even with their collective tails between their legs? If so, who would even watch them at this point? I certainly haven't been. I think you're right about that. One of the interesting... This is how it went with the... Canadian Human Rights Commissions. And all of us, my editor and the corporate suits at Rogers Communications and our wonderful KC, Julian Porter, or QC, as he was then. But our whole position was we weren't going to defend what I'd said. So we weren't going to say, oh, well, when he said such and such, he was referencing a statistic that was published in Le Monde in 1987. We weren't going to do anything like that. We were going to make the commissions. We weren't even particularly going to talk much about the plaintiffs, the Canadian Islamic Congress. We were going to make the very fact of the existence of these commissions the central legal question, because we rightly adjudged that they couldn't withstand the scrutiny. They couldn't withstand the cleansing, the light of sun rays on what they did. And that's what we did. And at that point, you know, I was just having a bit of back and forth with Raisa Blommerstein, who was on the Mark Stein cruise last year and is facing a similar situation in the Netherlands. And I said to her how much had gotten worse in the last 15 years. Because the fact of the matter is then that the media weren't able to ignore it. And so even the twits at the CBC had to do stories, you know, why is the Canadian state prosecuting Mark Stein and this thing, like heavyweight mainstream shows. Now, what's happened since then is there's been a generational turnover in the media. So all those people have retired. And you now have a media that is actually full of more. I mentioned this when I was talking the other day about the decline in court correspondence. Because, again, Anne McElhinney and Phelim McAleer talked about this on one of our shows. You don't have proper court correspondence anymore. So when it's my trial, they send their climate correspondents, the ones who are basically stenographers for Michael E. Mann anyway. So they just send their climate correspondents along to sit on the trial and write it up from these attacks on climate scientists have to stop, etc. From that point of view, they don't actually have people who understand the legal questions. And it's the same with the Trump trial. But as Anne and Phelim said about the Harvey Weinstein thing, if there's anything contrary to the narrative, suddenly you can hear a pin drop in the courtroom because all the journalists have stopped tapping away on their little laptops and telephones. So I don't think what we did 15 years ago is possible anymore. I really don't. It's one of the things that's got worse. I mean, I'm going on. I'm staggering on for as long as I live, really. I mean, in the case of the DC court, I won't live long enough to see it finally disposed. It's one thing I think it's an evil system. It's one reason I'm in a kind of fermenting mood about overthrowing the whole thing. And I understand, you know, people think that my disillusion with the system is because I've been on the receiving end of it. But, you know, the fact is, how do you think Trump feels, right? All he did, right, he's a super wealthy guy. And as he correctly said, once you get to a certain level of celebrity and wealth, you can grab them by the whatnot or whatever. You know, so he could have had a very agreeable, he could have spent his last 10, 15, 20 years on Earth having a very agreeable time. And instead, he decided he wanted to do something for his country because his country was crying out. And what was necessary, you know, you had people who talked a lot of sense on immigration 10 years ago. People who understood that actually America was increasingly a racket to screw over the unfashionable people, what Hillary called the deplorables, the ones nobody cares about. You know, if if you're a 17-year-old female track athlete who's hung like a horse, Hillary and all the others are all fascinated by you. You know, you can be a statistically undetectable niche demographic, and the Democrats will be all over for you. But if you're just tens of millions of loser guys from towns where all the jobs got shipped to China, so you've got a choice between doing the night shift at the quickie crap or starting your own meth lab. And Trump decided he wanted to do something for those people. And that's creditable. Very creditable. Compared to the Uniparty that has done nothing for them. And you needed someone of Trump's size to be able to bust through, you know, someone, it didn't matter. They already knew him. They'd watched him on TV. They got his persona. So you couldn't do this thing where, you know, oh, yes, we've looked into him and he had a contentious divorce in 1974. None of all that stuff, the stuff they can do to everybody else. The Mitt Romney thing, he put his dog on the roof of his car and he drove that dog to Canada. And no self-respecting American dog ever wants to go to Canada, certainly not on the roof of the car. They couldn't do all that to him because he was big enough to be beyond all that. And he's been repaid by this, which is just terrible. I mean, this is the thing. They're doing it so there will never be another Trump or the possibility of another Trump. Because why would you want it? You know, there were moments, as I said, during the more depressing days of my trial, there were moments when I just didn't want to wake up in the morning. I'd love to have died in my sleep. Because after, it's hard to retain an interest in the legal principles when you're starting your 13th year in it. Then it's just something that is, doesn't matter, you can't win or lose. Trump can't win or lose, really. I mean, he can. He's in a better situation than me in that he can win the election and be vindicated, supposedly, although I'm not sure they haven't made arrangements for that. Peggy Noonan did this thing. Oh, Trump's going to have a great time in prison. Really? Peggy Noonan? I always liked Peggy's company. I thought she was very pleasant. She was nice to me. But this idea that, you know, oh, Trump will have a great time in prison. Really? You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think it's an evil system, and I agree with James Allen. Trump reached the age of 75. He'd never been charged with a crime. Suddenly, in the year before an American election, he gets charged with a bazillion crimes. So he's basically someone who had a crime-free existence. Until he was 75 or whatever. We have a new jury note. They're asking to reread the judge's instructions. That's going to take him a fair bit of time, so we can definitely say we will not be getting a verdict today from that evil, evil system. JC of Western Supermare says, "Hi, Mark. Before I became fully aware of the many benefits of Stein Club membership," this is John Creasy of Western Supermare, which is John Cleese's neck of the woods. Don't know what it's like these days. It's his many decades since I've been in Western Supermare. "Before I became fully aware of the many benefits of Stein Club membership, I was a regular listener to the London Calling podcast with Toby Young and James Dellingpole, especially during the lockdowns. Of course, they ended when James became tired of Toby's fence-sitting and denialism on key issues, e.g. the stolen 2020 election, and they ceased to have any meaningful exchanges." Yeah, I didn't listen to it regularly, but whenever I heard it, I felt that James had the better of the arguments. And he goes, thereafter, I listened for a while to the Weekly Skeptic podcast with Toby and Nick Dixon, until I too became fed up of Toby Young's fence sitting and also with Nick Dixon's constant whining, often directed at his audience. Yeah, Nick Dixon is a comedian. I think he's on that show on GB News Headliners. Last week, through the Daily Skeptic website, I saw that they were to discuss Ofcom's latest judgment against GB News on the Sunak People's Forum, so I thought I would give them another listen. Whilst they think that Ofcom's judgment is totally unreasonable, they still trot out the feeble line that GBN has to operate within the broadcasting guidelines if it is to retain its license. It does not appear to occur to them that there are strong grounds for a GB News challenge, and scorn was poured on the idea that GBN had previously sacrificed presenters like you and Dan Wooten in an attempt to appease Ofcom. Interestingly, Toby Young also revealed that he had had a direct conversation with Ofcom to prep for a piece he was writing. Very cosy, don't you think? Toby Young has done some great things via his The Daily Skeptic and the Free Speech Union, but he still appears to play it safe on certain issues. Do you think he's just another paid-up member of the establishment? By the way, does he still owe you dinner? Yes, he does. I took him to dinner in German Street, right? He had a bottle of Chateauneuf du Pape, which is pricey if you order it in a restaurant in German Street. I bought him dinner. It was in part of my general subsidy of GB News. Anyway... No, he hasn't bought me dinner. And anyway, I wouldn't accept an invitation. I'd be washing my hair. It's like the late Peter Cook, when David Frost called him up and said he was having Andy and Fergie, the Duke and Duchess of York, were coming round to dinner, and they'd specifically asked if Peter Cook would be available. And so David was, and, oh, well, thank you very much, David. Let me go and check my diary. I'll be back in a moment. So he stepped away from the phone. He waited 12 minutes, made David Frost wait 12 minutes. Then he said, oh, I'm terribly sorry, David. I'm washing my hair that night. And that's how I would react to a Toby Young dinner invitation. James Dellingpole his father was Lord Young, the guy who came up with the phrase meritocracy. I think it's difficult. You have to be careful when James Dellingpole has one foot in the respectable world, in that he's the telly critic of The Spectator, but The Spectator wouldn't let him write about, you know, they wouldn't let him write about the World Economic Forum of it or any of that kind of stuff, you know, wherein. But the fact is, once you step on the, once you notice that what you thought was solid ground seems to be increasingly wobbly and perilous, it's easy just to get dragged, you know, way over. I try to think things through, but there are no, you know, the respectable answers don't cover most of what is happening. In respectable terms, the amount of money, there's no respectable answer about the amount of money that is being sunk into Ukraine. There's no respectable answer to all this weird war talk about how we have to get ready for the Third World War and all the rest of it. And James, on the whole, James has a better track record on the last 4 years than Toby does. No question of that. Absolutely none whatsoever. Let's see. We've got time for maybe. Well, I'm beginning to lose my voice. Greetings, Mark, says Sabre Mike Carroll. Says, greetings, Mark. Saw something on X that sums up how dumb and useless the GOP is, with the opposition candidate being put through a show trial for a crime the moron DA can't even coherently explain. He's not a moron DA. He's not a moron DA, Sabre Mike. He's a very clever one who has actually created an astonishing precedent. That for political reasons, the candidate of one of the only two political parties you have in this country, so it's not like in the UK where when Nicola Sturgeon's hubby is being criminally charged or whatever, if you add them all up between the national parties and the Scottish, Northern Irish and Welsh regional parties, there's over a couple of dozen of them. Not like that here. There's only two parties, and when one of them is being charged with a crime that can't even be agreed upon, that's not because the DA is a moron, but because the land of laws, equality before the law. If you don't have that, you don't have nothing. And the question is, and by the way, as I said, I'm not allowed to ferment. So I shouldn't be fermenting the violent revolutionary overthrow of the United States government, no matter how much I may want to. But the fact is, a system that does not have equality of the law cannot command the allegiance of its citizens. So this guy isn't a moron. He's doing what is necessary. Because the idea is that it's exactly the same thing with Brexit, where the equivalent of the deep state subverted Brexit. He wants to make the price that's paid for opposing the uniparty rubbish that is turning our countries into third world dumps and killing our civilization so effectively that people won't even know what they've lost, which, as I said, is the reason we talk about history on this website. With the opposition, Sabre Mike continues, with the opposition candidate being put through a show trial for a crime the moron DA can't even coherently explain, Ted Cruz tweeted out about his efforts to push a bill to save college sports. Not only is he wasting valuable time and resources on something absurdly trivial compared to all the important issues. Yeah, he's right, actually. Just to say, we don't need to save college sports. We don't need to save college anything. In fact, what is necessary is for all American colleges to be droned from the sky and the ground salted and nothing permitted to go there for the next 200 years. This whole... I understand there are some people who like college basketball or whatever. You should be able to play basketball without the involvement of institutions of higher learning, right? Because the institutions of higher learning... Oh, yeah, I point this out all the time, that in 1939, the average American had an eighth grade education. That's 13. He left school at 13, for those of you who aren't American. And that was the America that emerged after the Second World War as the dominant power, the 1950 moment. That was an eighth grade America that built that America. Now people say, oh yeah, I was thinking of leaving after the eighth grade, but then, I thought I'd stay on till 28th grade, take out $250,000 in debt because I didn't quite qualify for the college football scholarship or whatever it was. It's not a conservative position, Ted. I mean, I know you're Canadian, but you should get that. Saving college right now. Not right now. As I said, in 2011, in after America, education is the biggest single structural defect in America, because staying on till 28th grade, staying in school till 28th grade is why you have later family formation. We put that picture of the Mr. and Mrs. Safi from Afghanistan, who are now living at public expense in London with their 11 children and the 12th on the way. You know why? Because they don't go to school till 28th grade. It obstructs efficient family formation. I think that's Steve Saylor's phrase, because it's the sort of thing he sees. All the, oh, I think everyone should have the right to go to college. Well, what are they going to do there? Well, it doesn't really matter. They can do transgender studies, or they can play, you know, some sport. Ted Cruz. Saber Mike goes on, he says, it's absurdly trivial compared to all the important issues. He is also in the bidding of people, the universities, who outright hate us and are our enemies. Leftists punish their enemies by any means necessary, while our side rewards them as the wallets of all the useless grifters keep getting fatter and fatter. Just celebrated my fourth year as a Markstein Club member. Keep on fighting the good fight, Mark. Thank you very much, Saber Mike. It is great to have you with us. You want some music? Nah, tough. We moved all that to Saturdays on Serenade Radio, 5 p.m. London time. That's 6 p.m. in Western Europe, or 12 noon North American Eastern. Hope you'll join me this weekend. It is our D-Day anniversary show. And the great thing about taking all the music out of Q&A is that we've got even more time to talk about Mitch McConnell, with occasional excursions into Ted Cruz. That's going to do it for today. Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen Cohen will round up the internet as only she can. And on Friday, we shall definitely have a new tale for our time. Don't miss it. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Markstein Club, come on in. The water's fine. Saber Mike left it, whatever it was, 3 years before he decided to sign up. But better late than never. And don't forget, for the Stein Shy chum in your life, there's a Mark Stein Club gift membership with his or her name on it. Stay safe, stay free, stay well, and from both me and the president, stay out of court.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.